This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Jeff Patak, Chief Ratings Officer at Morningstar Research Services.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance and Retirement Planning for Morningstar.
Our guest this week is Dhananjay Fadness. DJ is the manager of the Fidelity Sustainable Asian Equity Strategy, which he has run since 2013. DJ joined Fidelity as an analyst in 2004 and has served in a number of roles during his tenure, including stints managing Fidelity Indonesia Fund, as well as Fidelity's Director of Research in Hong Kong. DJ graduated from Pune University in India and holds a postgraduate degree in management from the Indian Institute of Management. He's a CFA charter holder and an associate of the Institute of Chartered Accountants of India. DJ, welcome to The Long View.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us. We're really excited about this conversation. Most of our listeners are here in the U.S., and therefore they're less likely to be familiar with you and the path you've taken to here. Can you give a quick thumbnail sketch of your career to this point?
Yeah, sure. So I have a degree in accounting, and I also did my MBA equivalent from one of the Indian Institute of Managements in India. I spent a couple of years on the sell side as a research analyst, which was in Mumbai, before joining Fidelity to help build out its investing team in India. And then I moved to Hong Kong in 2006, and I've covered many different sectors, also had a stint as a director of research, managed several different funds, including country funds, as well as regional funds. And more recently, I've kind of focused now on managing our sustainability franchise here, so our Asian ESG products based out of Hong Kong still.
You were recently holding about a third of Fidelity's sustainable Asian equities assets in Chinese domiciled stocks. You're an experienced hand when it comes to the Chinese market. Given that, we're hoping that you can place the recent market turmoil there in a broader historical perspective. When we look back on this, what do you think we'll take away and what implications does it have for investors like you in the future?
Yeah, it's a very relevant question, especially considering what we've been seeing in the markets. But I would say, if you think about emerging markets, volatility and changing regulations, and in some countries, changing political landscapes, this is part of the overall picture which emerging market investors do need to consider when they think about allocating money into different markets. But more specifically, Christine, to your question on China, the way I kind of see what's going on, simplistically, I would sort of put it into three different buckets. The first one is a regulatory catch-up. So if you think about some of the recent regulations around anti-monopoly, privacy regulation, significant market power, I see a lot of these as being a catch-up where till now, companies were allowed to kind of run their operations without significant oversight. But I think some of that is changing and kind of aligning with what we already have in some of the developed markets like US or even in Europe. So firstly, that's the regulatory catch-up. The second thing has been an ongoing exercise in China, which is to control financial excesses. And you've seen that several groups, even though they could be called as being loosely linked to the state, have been sort of allowed to default and restructure. And in a way, they're taking the moral hazard out of the system, which is kind of the second point. And the third aspect, which I think is a little bit isolated, and I won't extrapolate a lot of that, is some of the China idiosyncratic measures to deal with some of the problems that the country sees. For example, they're sort of looking at a population decline, sort of a demographic headwind in the years to come. And some of the regulations we've seen seem to tackle that particular aspect of it. I would say that the first couple of them, which is the regulatory catch-up or the push towards deleveraging and better balance sheet management, I think those are both positive. The third one, which is a little bit more specific to the challenges of the country, I think those are a little bit difficult to call. But, I just kind of use this framework as a way to sort of simplify what's going on. And as long as you can kind of slot it into one of these three buckets, I think it helps you develop your investment strategy in terms of the risks you take and the positions you want to allocate to.
And so maybe building on that, you can talk a little bit about how that has changed the way you invest, if at all. There are arguments for investing in the stocks of dominant firms that throw off lots of cash. And in fact, I think you preferred owning those kinds of high quality names in the past. But if their dominance invites scrutiny, does that have to be factored in ways that it hadn't been previously? Maybe you can discuss it in the context of your stake in a few of the high quality names that you own.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the environment is continuously changing. And I think any analysis has to build in some of the changes that are coming through. But then again, like I said before, you need to think about it in the three different aspects in terms of what's going on. And that kind of helps you simplify your framework. And once you've done that, I think historically what we've seen is companies which are able to comply to the new regulations, they're able to adapt. Those are also the companies which can continue to grow and add so much value. And we've seen that again and again in history where regulations come and go, market environments change, but the good businesses run by good management teams are able to come through it and still continue to add value quite significantly. But if you think about sort of the more recent phenomena around the regulations in China, I would say, you know, we've been materially underweight some of these internet-driven sectors for some time now. And I would say we've seen a couple of challenges around things. E-commerce, for example, we are seeing significantly heightened competition, which is putting pressure on market share of some of the incumbents, but also leading to significant margin pressure. And on the other side, you also have companies which are involved in gaming or advertisement-driven businesses. And there again, the recent regulations, as well as a potential macro slowdown, which we might sort of be expecting into the near future, you know, those are going to again become headwinds for earnings. So it again, I think all boils down to the earnings outlook. And I think what's happening in China, we kind of are tempted to attribute a lot to regulations. But if you actually think about competitive dynamics, you know, the impact on businesses, I think it all boils down to earnings. And we are potentially going to see an earnings slowdown in some of these sectors which have historically grown very fast.
We wanted to switch over and talk a little bit about supply chains and inflation. We're continuing to hear about snarled supply chains, especially in Asia. So what are you seeing and hearing from the companies that you follow yourself or from your analysts who cover them on your behalf?
Supply chains have been an extremely topical issue. You know, we're still seeing significant dislocation in supply chains across the region and across the world. If you think about some of the biggest manufacturing hubs in Asia, you know, we've gone through a few lockdowns, you know, countries like Vietnam, and even in most of the manufacturing parts around Asia, we are seeing some dislocation there, and that's leading to very tightened supply chains. But also what happens when you see a potential for supply chain disruption is an extremely strong inventory rebuild cycle. So you know, if you're using a certain commodity or using a certain product into your supply chain, there is a tendency to build, you know, buffer stocks and safety stocks. Having said that, what we are noticing more recently is that some of these shortages are beginning to ease off. So you can see already in some of the semiconductor industries, maybe even in the auto supply chain, you know, towards the end of the year, we could potentially see easing in some of the tightness we've been seeing so far. Another sector is container shipping, which is again showing signs of easing so far in terms of supply chain pressure. So I would say supply chain pressure still exists depending on how we get out of the lockdowns in some of the key manufacturing hubs. But I see signs that some of those supply chain issues are being resolved and, you know, inventory in the system is reasonably high. And to that extent, the unwind also can be quite meaningful.
A related issue is inflation. Do you think we've shifted into a different regime that we'll see higher inflation? Or do you see the recent uptick in prices, some of those being supply chain related, as something that will recede over time?
This is, again, hard to call. You know, as a bottom-up stock picker, I spend pretty much most of my time looking at stocks and understanding, you know, how some of these things going on can affect my companies in terms of earnings. And inflation is an important variable. It's just really hard to call. What we are seeing in terms of inflation, you know, more recently, we've seen a big surge in commodity prices, which is beginning to feed through in the cost structure of some of these companies. And the analysis I try to focus on is, which of my companies have strong pricing power to be able to pass that on, and which of these companies could go through cost and margin pressure. So supply chain disruption will have somewhat of an inflationary impact. The key question in my mind is how much of that is permanent and how much of that is transitory? And again, which of my companies are able to pass on and absorb some of these pressures and which of them cannot sort of absorb these pressures? So I've not answered your question, Jeff. You know, it's a hard one to call, but we're really approaching this on a stock-by-stock basis and understanding where, you know, earnings could be impacted.
We've spoken to a few managers who focus on Asia. We have talked to Jason Su, Martin Lau, and now you. Based on your experience, what are the biggest adjustments an investor who's accustomed to investing in, say, U.S. stocks would have to make if they were investing in Asian stocks instead?
So I think, you know, investing in emerging markets is a whole different story, a whole different approach required generally when you think about, you know, versus developed markets like the US. In terms of sort of more specific differences, I would say compared to the US, for example, which is, you know, one country, when we think about emerging markets or even Asia, we are talking about many different countries. Each of them has a different economic construct, a different system of governance. So I think it's very important to take into account some of these specificities that you see. And then when you think about analyzing stocks, you have to put that into the context of the environment that they operate in. So I would say it is a more complex kind of area to be investing in. But I think that's where there's a huge opportunity for an active investor who has ideally an on-the-ground presence to be able to decipher some of these issues and to be able to piece together a portfolio, which is picking up some of the best parts of the universe and to be able to put together with full understanding of what the on-the-ground realities are. The last thing on this I would say is that an awareness of history is extremely important. You know, we've gone through many different cycles in emerging markets, and it's important to take that into account. For example, you know, one of the first things I did when I started managing money in Asia was to study the history of the Asian crisis. And I think even today, some of these lessons from the Asian crisis are extremely relevant. And I think taking that into context can also help any investor who's trying to approach emerging markets.
Since you mentioned it, what are some of those lessons that you think are especially relevant right now?
I think, you know, a few lessons from history are relevant in the sense that, you know, firstly, focus on balance sheet is extremely important. And if you think about different crises we've had in different parts of Asia or even emerging markets, you know, it's important that you understand balance sheets, balance sheet strength. Think about FX mismatch, foreign exchange mismatch in terms of debt levels that any company might be carrying. I think that's really important. I would say the biggest one is sort of an appreciation of cycles where you do get sort of boom and bust cycles around some of these emerging markets. I would say the sort of boom and bust cycles have become a little bit less volatile compared to what we've seen in history, but still you can't escape those cycles. And I think the ability to understand what an upcycle looks like, where the excesses build up, how the macro environment changes and that affects companies. And then to think about the other side where, you know, you go from positivity potentially to extreme bearishness. And again, the sense of what it feels like, which companies do you want to bet on, which companies are going to survive these crises and emerge stronger. So I would say appreciation of cycles is probably the most important lesson to draw from history.
If somebody were to look at the portfolio that you managed, which we mentioned before, and decipher sort of who it is you are as an investor, how it is you structure the portfolio, I mean, they'd see that you spread assets across 70 or so names, you concentrate to a certain extent in your top 10 holdings, which I think soak up more than 40% of assets. I mean, you could make other choices. You could concentrate to an even greater or lesser extent. Why have you built the portfolio as you have? And what do you think an investor looking at that should glean about your investment philosophy and portfolio construction approach?
Yeah. So firstly, I think I would say, you know, I'm supported by a really strong investment team and research team on the ground here in Asia. And, you know, this is something we're very proud about at Fidelity, where, you know, we have been investing in research as part of our DNA in terms of the research that we have built out here. And I think that helps me a lot in terms of picking stock ideas and trying to build a portfolio which aligns also with my core style and process. But in terms of the number of stocks, you know, I would say it kind of boils down to my own mental bandwidth in terms of my ability to be on top of my stocks and understand each and every stock in the portfolio really well. I feel like, you know, that's kind of my comfort zone in terms of, you know, between 50, 60, 70 kind of stocks, depending on, you know, new idea generation versus what's happening in the core portfolio. But on the portfolio level, so when you think about the concentration within the portfolio, for me, the bet sizes are really driven by three different aspects. You know, firstly is the conviction I have in the stock position. Second is the horizon, which typically my horizon tends to be 3 to 5 years. And that's very important for how I size the bet. And third is liquidity in the portfolio. And, you know, liquidity is a really important criteria and something, again, worth bearing in mind if you're investing in emerging or Asian markets. You know, in these markets, typically when in a bull market, there's plenty of liquidity in stocks. But when the tide turns, there's hardly any liquidity to unwind your positions. So that's why I think liquidity is extremely important. And that's why that's built in as a key part of my process. So I look at conviction, horizon, liquidity. That kind of drives the level of concentration in the portfolio. You'll see that some of the core positions in my portfolio have been there for a really long period of time. They are what constitute the biggest part of the risk. And then there's a middle section of the portfolio, as well as some of the entry-level stocks, where I'm typically building conviction, doing more work, doing more analysis, or potentially waiting for a valuation catalyst before I size up these positions for them to then go into the core positions.
We wanted to switch over to discuss ESG investing. You see sustainable investing as additive to traditional investing approaches that didn't take such factors into consideration. Can you explain why, and also where you think your process gets the most bang for its buck in terms of incorporating sustainability?
You know, sustainability, to my mind, is an extremely broad process or a broad concept versus traditional investing. So if you think about traditional investing, it's essentially been concerned with maximizing return per unit of risk. And I think this is a very narrow concept in that traditional investing pretty much ignores the externality any business can have. And by that, I mean an externality which affects, you know, all stakeholders. So when we think about sustainable investing, we are thinking about the effect any business has on its wider stakeholders. And these could be employees, you know, customers, communities, the environment, which are aspects which a traditional investing process may completely ignore. And that's what kind of induces risk sometimes to some of these traditional kind of analytical models, which just fail to acknowledge the risks that a business faces by ignoring or working to the detriment of some of the key stakeholders in this business. And if you think about how, you know, our investment process around sustainability has come about, is very much a process which was always focused significantly on investing in quality compounding businesses and traditionally following a little bit of a narrower definition. But I think when you think about it in a broader context, I think this is the right way to invest in a business, which it mitigates the tail risks that come with ignoring stakeholders, for example, but also to invest in businesses which can be long-term compounders. And to your question, Christine, about how we kind of make a difference in that approach, I would say some of the biggest advantages we have here at Fidelity is our proprietary ESG rating system, which leverages our key strength, which is our fundamental analyst research team, which has a very strong connect in understanding businesses. And we can leverage that to put our understanding of businesses and put our ESG understanding in that context to have a much better, robust, and forward-looking analysis of the ESG processes of any company. But also that's helping us drive a lot of integration into how we look at each and every stock idea. But most importantly, you know, one of the core pillars of our process is around engagement. And this is where we spend a lot of time ourselves speaking to companies, sometimes educating them, but most importantly, working with them as partners in their investing journey, in their sustainable investing journey, which is kind of underpinned by our belief that businesses which are investing for the long term and working in a sustainable manner are also the same businesses which will mitigate risks and deliver long-term compounding value. And that's exactly where we are aligned with our companies. So we see ourselves as partners. And I think the last thing I would say is that we also are trying to make a very genuine approach and genuine progress on this. So we're still learning, we're still improving, but we very much think of our role as investors and asset allocators as having a wider benefit to all the constituents involved.
That's helpful. I wanted to talk about the rechartering you did of the strategy. I think that took place earlier this year where you labeled it a sustainable investing strategy. It didn't seem to entail a lot of portfolio changes, but I think one of the things that you and your team have said is that you're stepping up your engagement with company managements, especially on non-governance matters, things like maybe their carbon footprint. So my question is, what is your rationale for why the market wouldn't have already priced in these firms' anticipated efforts to do things like shrink their carbon footprint? Because there could be a lot of other analysts that are having similar engagements with the same management teams, drawing conclusions similar to yours that there's an opportunity to shrink the carbon footprint and it might have been priced in. So what sort of situations are you looking for where you think engagement of this sort can make a difference?
Yeah, I think that's a very important question. I think it boils down to the fact that ESG investing is still at a very early stage in Asia. So if you think about some of the reporting requirements, the details you're getting from different companies is still very scarce. It is improving very quickly, but we're also seeing disclosures as being, so far at least, very early stage. And I think what is required here and what is very clearly required here is an approach which just goes beyond these scant disclosures to be able to put in context the ESG issues that a company is facing and the fundamental context that they are operating in. And I think that's where it's very important to have, firstly, an understanding of what the issues are. So, you know, you can go through materiality mapping, and that's where our internal rating system, we think, you know, makes a big difference in understanding the actual key issues. And I think the second part is very important, because while a lot of investors seem to be involved in engaging with companies, I think very few of them have a dedicated approach to it. So in many cases, I feel like the conversations are, you know, a side conversation to what is essentially a stock discussion. In our case, we are making a genuine, dedicated approach towards engaging with companies and talking about a wide sort of variety of a wide range of issues that every company faces. So it encompasses, like you pointed out, ENS factors, which is environment and social factors, but also, of course, governance factors too. And I think by being partners of these companies, by being long-term investors, I think companies also see us as trusted partners who are aligned with them to drive long-term returns. And that's what allows us to have a very constructive two-way conversation. And that's where I think the power of engagement is coming through. And, you know, it's been a short period, but just over the last 1 year, we've had so many fruitful and engaging conversations with companies, which we're already seeing our ability to be partners in those companies' journey as they move forward with that process.
What's an example of a name in your portfolio that you wouldn't own if not for its ESG merits? And conversely, perhaps you can provide an example of a name you would own were it not for its poor sustainability profile.
Yeah, so on this one, you know, one thing I would like to highlight is that we are running the funds, the Fidelity Sustainable Asia Fund, based on a dual objective. So not only do we want to invest sustainably, but we also want to generate a return as we go about it. So on this principle, we would not own a stock just for its ESG merits if the projected returns don't make sense. For example, if a whole ESG thematic is widely overvalued, you know, we would stay away from it because it will contravene with our second dual objective, which is to generate returns. So in Asia, there are many companies which you will see actually have a poor sustainability rating, especially when you look at it through a third-party kind of rating provider lens. But I think that's where we see it differently. We see it as an opportunity to engage with the company and help drive that ESG improvement. Like I said before, these companies which we like to term as ESG improvers are actually the companies which can also drive a significant delta in your portfolio in terms of helping you capture the significant value addition that this business can drive by, you know, better disclosure, better processes, you know, much stronger alignment with ESG metrics. So again, you know, no company, except of course companies which are in our core exclusions part, you know, every other company, we kind of look at it and say, can this company improve? What is the direction of travel when it comes to ESG metrics? And if this is an ESG improver company, which we think we can engage with and help drive that positive difference, you know, we would still want to own companies which fall in that category. So our portfolio is a blend of at least 70% in, you know, already validated high quality ESG raters or ESG issuers, but also up to 30% of the portfolio is dedicated towards these ESG improvers. And like I mentioned, we're trying to drive that improvement and capture the value that gets created from such things.
And so I take it that in that other 30%, we're unlikely to find something like the stock of a mining firm that's a really poor environmental steward, but maybe it's gotten crushed, and so it's dirt cheap. In situations like those, they wouldn't even make it into your 30% bucket just because the sustainability profile is so poor and it can't be improved through any engagement or other efforts that you would undertake?
Yes, exactly. So if there's a company with, you know, questionable practices and, you know, having looked at that company and we validate that company and we see really no potential for engagement or improvement, you know, this is a company we would classify as not investable for our funds and sort of park that on one side. You know, when our analysts also rate companies via our proprietary internal rating, they also kind of have a momentum score in terms of, is this company improving, stable, or deteriorating? And this company that you described, Jeff, would typically fall in that deteriorating category, which is kind of going nowhere and has questionable practices and would not meet our investment criteria.
Maybe if I can follow up, just to take the flip side. So maybe it's a firm that checks all the boxes from an ESG standpoint and therefore fetches a high multiple. I think you've already said that you're not going to pay through the nose to own it just because it's ESG good, so to speak. But I'm curious whether, you know, as ESG is gaining traction in the region, albeit it's still in a nascent state, are you seeing pockets where maybe it's gotten a little bit out of hand and investors are loving a certain firm or sector to death because it's perceived as being ESG good?
Yeah, I think, you know, whenever there's a big rush into one new area or, you know, there's investors looking at, you know, whole new thematic or area, there are very likely to be bubbles. And we've seen that through history, right? Every new concept or new thing that comes up, you know, there is a little bit of exaggeration that happens. So bubbles will form. And I would say in some sectors, bubbles are probably have formed. So we're very mindful of valuation. So when we look at, like I said, we have a dual objective. So we can't compromise on the return objective just to chase an ESG thematic. Having said that, if you look at the portfolio, Jeff, you'll see that we've managed to get access and exposure to several good, I would say, ESG thematics. I mean, if you look at, you know, some of the battery manufacturers in Korea, you know, we've had exposure to that from a very early period, and that's helped the portfolio. But, you know, even in Philippines, we are seeing a position where there's a utility which is clearly making a remarkable transition towards renewable energy. And that's been, you know, another successful position in the portfolio. And even in China, you know, you think about stocks in the wind energy sector and the renewable space. A lot of these positions in the fund have been where we've managed to get these positions at very attractive valuations. And that search continues. So we're very much mindful where bubbles are forming. We want to avoid those areas. But because, you know, our approach is a bottom-up stock selection approach, we're continuously looking for new ideas. And I can say in Asia, you know, we are blessed with a very rich pool of stock ideas. And so that journey continues. And as an active investor investing through our research team to understand stock by stock, I think we're still managing to find some really good ideas.
So shifting over to talk a little bit about how you approach selecting specific stocks and how you approach certain sectors, I wanted to talk a little bit about the semiconductor space. Can you talk about how your view of what is a fair price to pay for a company in that space has evolved and explain why? Because it was pretty routine in the past to pay a lower multiple, a mid-teens multiple to own the shares of even the best firms in that space 5 or 10 years ago, but they were recently trading for around double that. So maybe you can just sort of address how you're thinking of what is a fair price in that space has evolved.
Yeah, I think the semiconductor space particularly has gone through quite a bit of evolution in terms of market structure over the years. So you look at the business like Foundry, where, you know, given the changes that Intel has gone through, you know, you're pretty much left with, you know, two leading players in TSMC and Samsung. And even if you look at the memory space, you will see that from being six or seven players maybe a decade ago, we are now down to essentially three companies, which is Samsung, Hynix, and Micron. And when you get a more reasonable market structure, you actually reduce some of the cycles or some of the cyclicality in the business. So historically, we would see a lot of capacity being added, a huge dive in prices, And then you need a couple of players to go bankrupt before the cycle comes back again. But now when you have a market structure where, you know, and there's a moat around this market structure, given the huge amount of money and capex required for any company to go back into these businesses, I would say that's been the biggest change, where it's a much more rational market. Investment cycles are much more rational. Capital allocation is reasonable. And to that extent, you will probably see less volatility in cycles. There will be cycles, but these just will be less volatile as we go forward. The other thing that's kind of changed is that, you know, we're still seeing strong demand for advanced nodes and memory. You know, that outlook seems to be quite strong, and that's somewhat reflected in the valuation multiple that you referenced, Christine. You know, one of the things, though, I would call out is that to our initial discussion around supply chains, like I mentioned, supply chains are beginning to ease somewhat. There's a lot of inventory which has been built up at some parts of the supply chain. So as this inventory unwinds and as supply chains normalize, there is potential for the semiconductor sector to go through a lower growth patch in the coming quarters, and investors should probably watch out for that. But I think if you are a long-term investor like me with a 3 to 5 year horizon, you will sort of see the benefits of the change in the industry dynamics as well as the long-term outlook for growth. And I think some of these stocks in the sector would still look quite compelling on a long-term view.
Maybe if we can ask you to generalize, building on that previous example concerning semiconductors, you describe the industry competitive dynamics, and in some respects, it seems like it's maturing and coalescing around, you know, sort of a group of very dominant, competitively advantaged names. What are some other industries where you're seeing a similar sort of dynamic play out? And then conversely, are you seeing some industries where there are signs of competitive decay, where the quality is eroding for whatever reason?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, and I'll try my best to answer that. In terms of where, you know, some of the biggest value generation can happen over sort of the medium term, especially in Asia, you know, one area, of course, is where we've seen significant disruption because of COVID, and the near-term issues have kind of dominated the discourse. I would say financials, quality financials in the region have, you know, taken quite a bit of knock as we've gone through COVID. There's still a fair bit of restructured assets sitting there. But as we see normalization, and we are seeing, you know, data in countries like India or even in ASEAN, some of these companies are coming through in a really good shape. And some of the concerns investors have had are going to be overcome. And here again, if you've been a lower quality company, you've been undercapitalized as a financial institution in any of these countries, I think it's going to be really hard for some of these companies to come back. But if you're one of the well-run, well-managed, well-capitalized financial or bank in the region, I think you are going to be able to come back much more strongly as the cycle improves. And, you know, these companies are coming in with, you know, strong levels of capital, and that should help them grow. The other area within financials I like is around insurance, which is still a very under-penetrated category. And as some of these companies continue to grow, they will be able to get significant compounding returns. The other area, which is a little bit complex, but I think it's complex in that it's not easy to identify winners as it has been in the semiconductor space, is potentially around healthcare. And here again, you are seeing companies in Asia now pretty much come onto the global stage. You know, Indian companies did that a few years ago, where they very much cracked the generics market by supplying into developed markets at a much lower cost. But what we are seeing now is a whole wave of biologics, large molecule, and innovative drug companies, which so far historically or might have been focused on their core market, for example, in China. But I think in the next few years, we will see some of these companies break out onto the global stage and can become substantial value creators when it comes to growing the business and getting re-rated in turn.
You own some stocks in the Macau gaming industry. Given that these casino operators hold just a handful of prized gaming licenses, they boast economic moats, but they can also court significant regulatory and ESG risks, and some have really gotten crushed this year. So can you discuss the outlook for companies in this space, and what gives you confidence that the regulatory and ESG risks have been more than priced in?
Yeah, so I think the recent sell-off that you've seen in some of the Macau gaming names has been due to some discussions around the concession renewal. So as you might know, some of these concessions, most of these concessions are rolling off. And this has been kind of well known. I think the recent correction in the market has been around the current paranoia around changing regulations. But I think what we're seeing in Macau has been well anticipated and should be expected to come through. So I feel like there's been a little bit of extrapolation that's been going on in this sector. The other complication, of course, is around COVID-19 and the fact that, you know, we're still seeing periodic outbreaks. And as the sector, which depends on people traveling into Macau, you know, that's clearly affected with the COVID restrictions that are in place. So I think both those issues are kind of course, relevant, but also potentially very transitory. And maybe when you look back at this 3 years from now, you know, these will sort of not register as being kind of big events when you think about the forward outlook. So again, with the caveat that it is really difficult to call regulations, you know, so far what I see as being proposed seems, you know, in line with what we've been expecting. And to that extent where if due process is followed, we should probably see many of these companies back on the track of growth. You know, these businesses historically generate significant cash flows. And when we are at the other side of the regulatory reset or the concession renewals, we should see the potential of some of these businesses to deliver significant value creation in the years to come.
Another area where you're active is biologics development and manufacturing stocks, and you might have alluded to it earlier in the conversation. You've been very successful here. You've had a few huge home runs there. As biotech and pharma firms have turned to outsourcing development and production, those firms have grown, and that's been reflected in the stock prices. But it is a competitive space, and some of your holdings look expensive. Can you talk about how you manage valuation risk in this particular area, and then maybe more generally in the portfolio, how you try to manage valuation risk?
Yes, I think like I pointed out, healthcare is sort of one of the more trickier areas to think about how, you know, a company grows and how you create value. You know, if you look at some of the standout companies in the sector, for example, you know, if you look at WuXi Biologics, WuXi AppTec, and many of their peers, you know, what we are seeing is just a phenomenal level of execution where, you know, a company like WuXi Biologics is now the global market leader when it comes to their business model, which is, you know, follow the molecule strategy from start to finish. And, you know, they've also been now developing significant manufacturing facilities across the world. And, you know, that allows them to handhold a customer from, you know, very early stage towards a go-to-market kind of strategy. So I think what we are seeing slowly and surely is that companies like these are kind of breaking out. And, you know, what we focus on when we think about investing in these companies is that we're looking at, of course, management quality and execution, but we're also looking at the level of innovation that they're investing in and the kind of teams that they're building around it, you know, talent retention. Some of these aspects are extremely critical. And, you know, an example like WuXi, again, is a clear example of a valuation analytical thesis where, you know, at the start, you kind of looked at what the business was delivering at the time of the IPO. Over time, not only have they executed far better than those expectations, there's also been a meaningful royalty stream. There's also been innovation, for example, on bispecific platforms. But there's also now the whole manufacturing side, which has developed. And that's what a good business creates, right? A good business continues to create optionality around their core businesses. And as those optionalities are fulfilled, you will start seeing value creation there. But to answer your question, Jeff, I think the approach that an investor needs to take is one of a probability-weighted scenarios to understand some of these different optionalities. So, you know, it's important to lay those optionalities out there, to put a probability weighting on them, to understand what the payoffs can be, and then to construct your portfolio and construct your bet size, taking that into account. So I think bet sizing in a portfolio is very important where you are expressing valuation sensitivity, even where, you know, some of the underlying thesis looks super compelling.
What do you think is the most misunderstood company in your portfolio where the market just doesn't seem to grasp the business fundamentals or outlook? And why is that?
You know, rather than sort of call out a certain company or so, I would say, at a fundamental level, where I think we in the portfolio are trying to drive an advantage is through what I like to call a horizon arbitrage. in that we are just trying to make sure that we are looking 3 to 5 years out in a market which is focused on being extremely myopic. So the market tends to focus a lot on what's happening now. And I think if you are willing to stretch a horizon into 3 to 5 years, I think you will be able to sidestep some of these sort of near-term, both euphoria as well as kind of downbeat feelings people might have or the market might have about stocks and sectors. Of course, it's very important when you take a long-term view to ensure that your companies have a strong balance sheet that can survive some of the near-term negativities. For example, COVID, which it was very clear that it was first important as a business to survive before you could think about, you know, buying into these stocks to see them compound and grow. So I would say that most of the differences in the portfolio are around that horizon. So, you know, I did mention some of the quality financials in the region where if you see your company as navigating some of these issues really well, you know, when you are 3 to 5 years out and you look back, you know, some of these companies are going to become the best value generators possible in the market. And that's extremely what I'm focused on. I'm trying every day to reduce the noise in the market and try to make sure that the process is focused on the medium to long term.
We haven't spent a lot of time talking about financials, but they are a big emphasis in the portfolio. I wonder if maybe there's a name in the portfolio that's high conviction for you, but where there is a bear case, a well-developed bear case that you've had to consider and basically sort of surmount, if you will. Is there an example that jumps to mind that you think is emblematic of your process and how it is you've approached financials in general?
Yeah, I think maybe I'll just give you a slightly longer answer here in terms of, you know, when we think about financials, you know, there are very different type of financials. So I kind of put financials in 4 key buckets, especially when it comes to Asia. The first ones are, you know, what look like very much developed market financials. These are typically rate sensitive financials. These are banks, I would say, in Hong Kong, Singapore, Korea, Taiwan, which kind of mimic European or Western banks. I tend to not sort of like these banks generally because I don't have a view. I don't take a view on the interest rate cycle, which is extremely hard to call. The second ones are state-owned banks, which often are not in control of their own destiny. There can be significant misalignment between minorities and management. And so we are very selective in this space. Again, a space which generally we don't invest in or don't like, but aside from, you know, a couple of them, which could be very different from the rest of the pack. The third and fourth categories are where I put most of my money. The third one being private sector banks. Typically, you know, you have HDFC Bank or Axis Bank in India, Bank Central Asia in Indonesia, and banks like those where they're well-run, well-capitalized, they've navigated cycles reasonably well. And going into the future, you know, we think these banks could, you know, create quite a bit of value going forward. And finally, I think another sector which I did mention is insurance, which, like I said, is a highly underpenetrated category. You think about companies like AIA or Prudential and the opportunity that they see in front of themselves, especially in China. I think that could be a meaningful game changer in the years to come. So I think just going back to your question, Jeff, I think it's really important to understand that alignment between management and minority shareholders, which prevents the business from making short-term decisions, which can come to a haunt. And in financials, it's particularly important because you have to remember these are leveraged businesses. They are built on other people's money, depositors, for example. And so it's really important that they don't make mistakes in a down cycle, but they're able to keep their processes to continue to grow in a growing market. And I think that's the framework we've always used for managing our positions in this fund. And so far, it's worked out quite well.
One other thing I neglected to ask you about is India. We know you're a bottoms-up stock picker and aren't going to sort of do the top-down thing where you pick a country to focus on. But that has been an area where you found opportunities through the years. So maybe you can kind of give a quick thumbnail of what it is you are or aren't, for that matter, seeing in India at the moment in terms of, you know, good opportunities that you feel enthused to invest in.
Yeah, I think India is an extremely interesting market in that it is really diverse and you see a lot of good quality businesses run by just phenomenal management teams. And it's amazing the kind of, even some of the newer companies which are coming to market, you know, there's a lot of innovation, a lot of drive. lot of alignment with minority shareholders. And to that extent, as a quality investor, you know, India is a great market to find some really good quality ideas. I think the challenge in India has historically been around valuations. And even if you look at the situation today, where India has been one of the standout market performers this year, you know, we are now seeing a lot of stocks now get into overextended territory. So I think I would kind of caution on valuations a little bit, which is a perennial concern. But more recently, that seems to be a little bit more exacerbated, mainly driven by the fact that India has come through quite reasonably well from the COVID 2 wave, which, as you might remember, was quite severe. But it seems like the economy is bouncing back really well. And there's a lot of kind of interest in capitalizing on that opportunity. So I still very much like India. It's just, like I pointed out, you know, we are sensitive to valuations. So we will make sure that we are not overpaying for businesses generally. But it remains a fantastic stock pickers market.
One question that we like to ask portfolio manager guests is, what is the most hotly debated subject on their teams at the moment? Can you share the topic that your team is actively debating today?
Yeah, we talk about a lot of issues, and you know, they tend to be a little bit more kind of near-term focused. We do kind of break out twice a year as a team to discuss some of the really long-term kind of ideas. But if you look at what's going on recently, it's not surprising in that, you know, we've been discussing the route to normalization from COVID in countries in ASEAN and India, for example, which have been significantly affected by COVID. And here comes the discussion around supply chains as well, which obviously is a big topic right now. Regulations in China has been quite topical more recently. And like I pointed out, we are trying to find companies which can comply and adapt. And we're trying to put our portfolios behind these companies. China property is an extremely hot topic right now, also dominated by our fixed income colleagues, for whom the space is also quite important. And we're trying to make sense of the deleveraging trend there. You know, we're seeing a couple of large property developers in some sort of distress and trying to understand the implications of what's going on there. And maybe, you know, like I pointed out on the India discussion, you know, valuations in India is also quite topical. So it's sort of understanding where things might have gone a bit too far and where the opportunity still exists. So very much focused on some of the key issues that we see today in Asia. And again, our focus here is to not get caught up in the short-term noise, but to understand what's going on and try to think about the longer-term implications of some of these events.
One final question. You used to be the head of research in the region, as we mentioned earlier in the conversation. Now you're obviously a portfolio manager. Knowing what you now know, based on your experience as a portfolio manager, what would you have told your younger self at the time you were heading up research?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think I find myself in a privileged position because, you know, going through the director of research route is not a typical route. You know, most people will join as analysts and sort of become portfolio managers. And I was very fortunate to be given the opportunity not only to be an analyst and a portfolio manager, but also to work with so many talented research analysts during that period. And when I look back at sort of my career then and over the years, I would say a few things stand out in terms of what I would advise my kind of young self is, you know, firstly, I think it's extremely important for an investor to invest in understanding yourself. So everyone's different. We all react to different pressure points differently. You know, some of us gravitate towards certain type of stocks. Some of us have very different investment preferences. And I think even in my case, it took me some time to understand myself. And I think it's extremely important that everyone spends time to analyze themselves. And, you know, there are many techniques that can help you. You know, writing an investment journal is one of the best techniques there. And I think it's extremely important as early as you can in your journey as an investor to understand yourself. And then once you've understood yourself, I think it's important to build a process and stick with it. You know, still even now you find so many people with a process which is all over the place, but I think it's really important to nail down what works for you and then build that into your core process. And I would say the final step is that once you have the confidence, you need to take risks. You know, so often we find talented stock pickers, but, you know, they kind of lack the conviction to take the risk. And I think it's very important to go that final step to take the risk, to make sure you're taking risk in the portfolios once you're confident about your process. And even today, you know, we have a lot of new joiners. We have a lot of summer interns who come work at Fidelity. And the three things I tell them very consistently is that you need to focus on conviction in your stock ideas, communication so that your stock ideas get into the portfolios, and finally, ownership, which is to have strong ownership of a stock idea regardless of how well it does or how poorly it does. You need to handhold that stock idea all the way through as it makes its way through the portfolios.
That sounds like wise advice. Well, DJ, this has been a really enjoyable conversation. Thanks so much for your time and insights. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Christine.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you could, please take a minute to subscribe to and rate the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number one.
And at Christine_Benz.
George Cassidy is our engineer for the podcast, and Carrie Gretchick produces the show notes each week. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Patak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.